Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Millions of undocumented immigrants in this country are hoping this is the year for immigration reform. On today's show, we explore what the future holds for mixed-status families. And then it's being called one of the most dramatic ecological recovery stories in North America. We'll tell you why a beaver along the Detroit River is such a big deal. But first, it's been a week now since Governor Snyder introduced Kevin Orr as Detroit's emergency financial manager. And it was a week ago that we last spoke with Daniel Howes, business columnist at the Detroit News. So it's time to do so again. Hello again, Daniel.
Hello, how are you?
Good, good. So Kevin Orr starts his new job on Monday. And in your column today in the Detroit News, you write that this is making you think of General Motors circa 2008. How so?
Well, you had management at the time who just could not get their heads around the fact that General Motors was facing an existential crisis. I mean, I think they knew that they were running out of money, and they went to Congress and begged for a bailout. But if you think back to that time, they really weren't prepared to do what ultimately needed to be done in exchange for that money. And as a result, two presidents from two different parties put money into General Motors, but they both had restrictions and conditions for the money. And I think the same kind of thing is what we're starting to see happen here. You have a city council that has slow-walked reform, did not fulfill a lot of the terms of a consent agreement that a majority of them signed, I think is showing not a lot of good faith. And as a result, now that the governor has called the question under laws that, by the way, have been on the books since 1990 in various iterations, they are wondering what their role is going to be. And I think increasingly what you see here is that when outside forces come in to fix an institution, the role of the people who were involved previously diminishes or is eliminated. Certainly in a corporate context, people lose their jobs and they get retired. And in this political context, I think increasingly the emergency manager is going to be making decisions and people are going to be more focused on the November elections than they are on the current crop of council members.
But let me just put this out there. A corporation is one thing. A democracy is something else. So what of the very strong view that bringing in this elected, unelected outside manager basically strips Detroit citizens of their right to elect a leader?
Well, that's true, although only about 15% of Detroiters voted in the last election. So, but I understand that, and I wouldn't diminish that. But on the other hand, where's the outrage over the current political leadership that has not delivered and consistently not delivered services for the citizenry? In fact, they've gotten worse. If you talk to people in Detroit, they will tell you that whether it's police and fire protection, EMS response times, picking up the garbage, keeping the lights on, you know, go down the list, they've continually gotten worse. And I think what you see with this council is more of an obsession with the power and control and their status than actually fixing the problem. And additionally, we do have emergency manager laws in Michigan that have been on the books since 1990. Now, there have been Public Act 4 that was passed, and then it was overturned in a referendum. There's a new Public Act that will go into effect next week, Public Right. Act 3436. You know, there is nothing that's written into the law that says that the city council members and the mayor have to be rendered totally irrelevant. And Kevin Orr, I think at this stage, you have to kind of take him at his word that he's going to try to work with council and work with the mayor. The governor has also made it clear that there are certain things that he would prefer not to do in these early days, weeks, and months in violation or against the wishes of council. And the best example is the whole Belle Isle lease deal. And he said, look, I really don't want to don't think we should go there unless a majority of council and the mayor say, yes, we think this is a good thing. Let's revisit it. And at that point, I think the governor would be prepared through Kevin Orr to revisit it. But I think there are certain things that he does not out of the box want to deal with. Instead, he wants to focus on service delivery and renegotiating liabilities with the various constituencies.
Dan, in your column today, you're arguing that it's right that over time, those associated with the past failures will begin to be sidelined, just as we saw with General Motors, and new leadership begins to emerge. Do you think that narrative will happen in Detroit? And I'm curious, who do you see on the scene today who could be promising as one of those new leaders?
Well, I mean, clearly we've got a whole new crop of people that are running for mayor, and the incumbent, Dave Bing, has thus far made it clear that he's not talking about running. That's not he's not saying he's not running.
Right.
But political pros who look at this say he doesn't look like a guy who's running. I don't think he looks like a guy who's running. Hmm. I think he looks like someone who wants to go out having tried to be part of the solution instead of being part of the problem. He certainly doesn't need another 4 years of this job. I think Mike Duggan is someone who will certainly has a turnaround cred that none of the other people thus far in the race can boast. Benny Napoleon, currently the Wayne County Sheriff, is expected to make his formal announcement, I think, next week.
Yes.
And I think everybody expects that that it's really going to be a two-way race in August for in the Democratic primary for the runoff in November. In terms of counsel, I don't think we really know. I mean, we have a situation now where the first time since 1918, Detroiters are going to be electing their representatives to council along district lines. Now, there'll be a couple of at-large members, but
yes.
That's been one of the criticisms of council for many, many years.
So that should be intriguing to see how that shakes out and who'll step forward from which district.
Right, and I think they're going to actually have to campaign as opposed to taking the top nine vote getters off of a bedsheet of names, which is typically what they've done in Detroit. I think there's going to be a finite number of names per district. Therefore, people are going to have to campaign. They're going to have to make the case why they can represent that district in various parts of the city that have different kinds of problems. One may be service delivery. Another may be crime. Another may be lighting. Another, I mean, there could be all sorts of different things. And I think the view is that it will be easier for a mayor to build political coalitions within council because there will be commonalities of interests among various districts. So it may be service delivery may be an issue in most districts. Therefore, if you have solutions and you put those things forward, you will be able to get it through council and you won't have this constant interminable foot dragging and inability to get things done.
Daniel Howell's column in today's Detroit News is entitled, Council's Role Will Fade as EMX. Daniel, always good talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So, it's here. March Madness. Now, for many of us, this is like Christmas in March. 68 teams vying to make it to the Final Four. For others, it's time for us to say goodbye to the sports fans in the house. Brace ourselves for 3 weeks of nonstop college hoops on TV, maybe while you're off reading a book or watching another TV in another room. But it is here. Time to talk March Madness as we welcome our sports commentator, John Eubagan, back to stateside. Good to have you here.
Cindy, great to be back.
So for those who don't get the magic of March Madness and why it is like Christmas in March for so many people, tell us how it's different than, let's say, the World Series or the run to the Super Bowl or the NHL Stanley Cup playoffs.
The biggest difference is there are 68 teams. Now, 64 makes sense, I grant you, but this is the NCAA. Their logic and greed will always supersede everything else. So 68 teams, every region of the country is represented. Big schools, small schools, Montana's got teams, Alabama's got teams, Maine, California. So everybody can play. And the TV has got games on constantly. So
yes, I know.
You might have noticed this.
I have.
But the real beauty is this. The person who's going to win your pool is the person who knows nothing about the sport. So all the Sharpies out there who think they've got the whole thing figured out, the crystal ball, the slide rule, all this crazy stuff, go home. You're not going to win. The person who wins is all the schools or he knows people, friends of his who went there. Or the woman who picks them on her favorite colors.
Or likes the name.
Or favorite mascots. You know, the cougar's going to beat the leprechaun every time, right?
Yeah.
So,
well, in fact, I guess when you talk about those brackets, I saw a statistic that the odds of picking the perfect bracket are 1 in 9.2 quintillion. And that is, by the way, 18 zeros, folks. That comes from calculations by Jeff Bergen. He's a math professor at DePaul University. So just what is it about these brackets that just pulls everybody in?
There's a case to be made for every team. The 5 seed versus the 12 team, they will get upset occasionally. There'll be, this weekend, probably 5 or 6 unbelievable upsets that no one saw coming. Giants falling. David and Goliath happens every day in March Madness, and David does pretty well.
And that's what's so fun about it, isn't it? That unpredictability, that some little team can be the giant killer, and the big guy goes home.
It's George Mason. It's Butler University out of Indianapolis. Gonzaga used to be one of the Cinderellas. Now Gonzaga is a top seed. A friend of mine called them America's team, and then I said, okay, if they're America's team, where are they? And he said, California. I said, you're off by two Western states. It can't be America's team if you don't know where in America they are. But they've got their following.
Now, I know everybody from the chief executive of the United States. I know President Obama filled out his bracket. You got yours. And is it cool to say who you think will be in the Final Four?
Great line from Dan Okrent, a friend of mine, a Michigan grad, who invented fantasy baseball. He said, there's nothing more interesting than your fantasy baseball team and nothing more boring than everyone else's.
What about overall with Big Ten teams? I've seen some headlines that don't seem to be faring well in at least the experts' picks.
Mixed bag. Right now, the Big Ten is considered the best basketball conference this past season. They've had 6-7 teams in the top 10 at various points. The flip side is, do you eat your own? It's the old painting. devouring her young, right? So this is what you have in the Big Ten. I still go back to the all-time great line. I believe it's Goldman from Hollywood who said the best line, talking about Hollywood, but it applies to sports, nobody knows anything. That's why we love it.
So we'll be talking with you as this three-week period unfolds. We'll certainly check in for Sweet 16, Final Four. We will be looking for insights and conversation. And then to those of you listening to us who are like, could care less, just, you know, get your Netflix queue loaded up, find a couple good books, and say goodbye to that person you love because they're going to be nailed to that TV.
Do one better. Pick all the schools with your favorite colors and beat your spouse at his or her own game.
I love it. John Ubakin, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, Cindy.
So here's a headline you may not have expected to hear us say. The beaver is back. You know, it's been something like 150 years since the beaver made its presence known along the Detroit and Rouge Rivers. The hardy little critters were done in by trappers and then by toxic water. But there are very encouraging signs that beaver and other species are enjoying a resurgence in Michigan. John Hartig is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and he joins us now. John, you seem pretty happy about this news.
It's a great news for our region.
Well, what are the signs that are telling you that beaver are indeed back in southeast Michigan?
Well, in 2008, we first discovered some beaver at the Connors Creek power plant at the upper end of the Detroit River. And they came in, built a lodge, and had a couple of pups. And just in the last month and a half, some workers at the River Rouge power plant noticed some trees being felled into the river and the bark being stripped off of it. And obviously, you would only think it would be a beaver. And so then they started seeing more and more in the piles of wood chips. And think about this. During the fur trade era, we literally hunted beaver to extinction. We literally eliminated all of them east of the Mississippi River. And then during the peak of the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. say from during the 40s through the 70s, there were few pollution controls, and there was so much oil in the river that the beaver could not survive because the oiled fur becomes matted and they lose their ability to trap air and water, which they need to maintain body temperature. So they would have died. So now that the river is cleaner, and there is some food for them in terms of the trees, we have a few beaver coming back. And we've seen them in, as I mentioned, Connors Creek Power Plant, River Rouge Power Plant. They're in an inland lake in the headwaters, the Rouge River. They're at University of Michigan Dearborn campus on the Rouge River. And they're over in Crosswinds Marsh. That's five locations in the Detroit River watershed. They've also been seen down at Sterling State Park in Monroe and across the river at in the lake over at Point Pelee National Park. So if you think about that from an ecological perspective, the beaver are expanding their range. And what a great story for us is to have beaver in our backyard.
You actually call this, John Hardy, you called it one of the most dramatic ecological recovery stories in North America?
Yes, during World War II, Michigan United Conservation Clubs called the Detroit River the most polluted river in Michigan because of the amount of oil. It was incredible. Think of Lake Erie in the 60s on the front of Time magazine as Lake Erie is dead because of phosphorus pollution and algal blooms.
I absolutely remember those headlines.
So that was the peak. So we had one of the most polluted rivers in North America. And now, just in the last, you know, five or more years, we've seen the return of lake sturgeon for the first time in 30 years reproducing in the Detroit River. We've seen the return of lake whitefish reproducing for the first time since 1916. Mm. We've seen walleye that were in a crisis state back in the 70s, and now we're part of the walleye capital of the world. They're an exceptional state. We had no bald eagles for 25 years. They're back nesting and producing young in seven locations here. We had peregrine falcons that were not reproducing for 25 years. And they're back in downtown Detroit on skyscrapers and in the Ambassador Bridge producing young. We had no osprey producing in this region, and we have osprey at the lower end of the river now, first time since the 1890s. If you add the beaver to that, it represents one of the most single greatest ecological recovery stories in North America, and that's in our backyard.
Does this say more about the tenacity of the species, or have we? Does it say that Michigan has truly done a noticeably good job in cleaning things up?
I think it says something that, you know, the environmental improvement of the river has laid the foundation for this ecological recovery. Are we done? Absolutely not. We have more to do to clean up the legacy in terms of contaminated sediments and contaminated brownfields. We've got exotic species. We've got the runoff off our lands that we have to deal with. We have global warming. We have some big challenges ahead, but it's really good to see that we have made these tremendous strides and improving the quality of the Detroit River, and as a result of that, these unique, charismatic megafauna returning to the Detroit River.
And isn't it lucky for these beaver in 2013, there's no demand for those shiny men's hats like they were in the 1800s that led to them being trapped out?
Absolutely.
But you really have to give those little critters their props for the role they played in really helping build Detroit, true? Because it was the traders that were trading those beaver pelts that helped this whole Great Lakes region become what it
Absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely. There were this region from Lake Erie to Saginaw Bay had more beaver than any other regions. And so the French, when they came here, they founded Detroit, and Cadillac built a fort and to protect the strait and to have a competitive advantage for the fur trade. So what amazing story. Important part of our past. It's also important part of our future.
So little original Detroit citizens are back at it.
Yes.
John Hartig is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Thanks for talking with us on Stateside, John.
Thanks so much, Cindy.
When you think of Masonic Temple in Detroit, chances are you might think of shows you've seen in the Grand Theater or the Scottish Rite Cathedral. But to a growing group of fans, Masonic Temple means roller derby. Detroit's Masonic Temple is the home rink of the Detroit Derby Girls. They're the official roller derby league in Detroit, and boy, you'd be amazed at the wide range of ages and backgrounds of the fans who come to cheer the ladies on. Joining us now are two of the Detroit Derby girls. We have J.T. Sanglin, a.k.a. ShamWow. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
And also with her is Tina Ulianelli, who's also known as Tiny Ninja, or if you're feeling lazy, Tinja. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I want to start with you, J.T. Tell us about the Detroit Derby Girls League. So how many skaters, how many teams, and kind of what are the age ranges?
So we currently have five home teams that make up our home season, and we play each other. And then additionally, we have two travel teams and a pickup team that are made up of sort of the best of those home teams. We have, I would say, about 80 skaters in the league right now.
Okay.
It's the sport is growing so exponentially quickly that you're getting more and more skaters. Every time we have a boot camp, it gets more competitive to try out for a team. So, yeah, we're probably closer to 100 now. Just an amazing variety of women from ages to backgrounds to sort of walks of life. It's probably one of my favorite things about the sport is just the variety of cool women you get to hang out with.
So give me an idea, Tina, like when you've got your teammates all around, what do folks do? What are their backgrounds?
We have quite the range of backgrounds and ages. I would say anywhere from early 20s to early 40s, making up housewives, school teachers, doctors, lawyers, professors, bartenders, retail managers, nonprofit organizers. I would say you name it, we could identify with any one of your listeners right now.
That is quite spectacular. So give us a sense of what is happening, the rules of the bout, if you will. What's going on and how many are on the team?
Each team fields 5 players at the start of the jam, 4 blockers per team and 1 jammer per team. So the jammer is the only point-scoring person on the track at any one time, and they wear the star on their helmet.
Okay.
And then there's 4 blockers trying to either assist their jammer or defend against the other jammer getting points. And sometimes we face off against each other, so it's a lot of fun.
And what is the jammer trying to do?
The jammer is trying to pass each person from the opposing team legally within bounds. Once they pass that player's hips, they earn a point for that player after the initial pass.
Huh. And so how long would you be out there for, a given? Now, it's not a game, right? It's a bout?
It's a bout.
It's a bout.
A maximum of 2 minutes per jam.
Okay.
And let's say JT and I are, ShamWow and Tinja are facing off against one another, and she gets out first. She now controls that 2 minutes, so she would be established as lead jammer. So if she's racking up points and I'm not, she can continue to play. And then if I start to gain on her position or if I'm doing better than she is, although she has lead, she can stop it at any time.
So I can stop her from scoring points. And for the record, if Tinja and I face off on the jammer line, it's usually Tinja that gets out in front.
Just giving her her due, right?
That's right. Thank
and, you. And how much body contact and how dangerous is it for you guys?
It's classified as a level 5 X Games sport. So we do have insurance through the league. We wear a helmet, wrist guard, elbow pads, knee pads, and mouth guard. But it is a full contact sport.
Or as our league physical therapist calls it, a collision sport.
A collision
sport. It's like being in several car accidents a week.
Oh, wow. All right. I want to hear your stories. I'm going to start with you, ShamWow. How did JT become ShamWow?
So my story is it's kind of a bit of a nerdy, funny story in Detroit. I went and saw the movie Whip It. I was particularly interested because it was filmed locally.
Yes, all over Ferndale. And yes.
So, I mean, I like Drew Barrymore. It was filmed locally. That was enough to sort of get my interest up. And I was watching it on a flight to Washington, D.C. And I remember by the end of the movie, I'd been a figure skater. I'm a big football fan. So I was like skating and hitting people like this sounds perfect. This was made for me. I wonder if I could do this. And so as soon as I got to a computer, I was searching for whether or not there was a league in Detroit and come to find out not only whether a league in Detroit, most of the skaters in the movie were people who were from League Detroit, Tinja being one of them. Mm. And their boot camp was coming up, I think about 8 weeks away. So I traded in ice skates for roller skates and went to boot camp, and I went to watch about first because I wanted to see the question you asked. How much are they going to, is this like break my face kind of activity, or could I withstand this? And I went to watch the first bout, which was a defunct bout that you were probably skating in against the Detroit Pistoffs, and I was hooked. Done.
That was it. You were in.
Yeah.
And how about you, Tina?
I went in blind. I was working part-time at a bar downtown, just cocktail waitressing, and one of the other bartenders had just joined the league. So I'm not a founding member, but I'm one of the very first waves of recruits. So there wasn't as much established boot camps or anything like there are now. And I was a rink rat when I was little. Friday, Saturday nights, I was at the roller skating rink, roller skating in my basement, skateboarding, snowboarding, all those kinds of sports.
That's why you're so good.
Thank you. And the bartender's like, hey, we're going to this thing. It's called the Bartender's Ball. We're going to roller skate down there. I'm like, oh, I have roller skates in my car. No way. Totally. So I bring them in. I'm like, here, these are my skates from when I was, in eighth grade. Why do you have them in your trunk? In case I ever break down, I can roller skate to the gas station. I didn't know. I just kept them with
just
me.
Had them.
So she's like, Monday, be at Riverside Arena in Livonia. Bring those skates. Okay. So I did. I tried out 2 days later, and I had my first bout a month later. Totally unprepared. Had never seen a bout. Had no idea what was going on. Just thought it was going to be for me, and 7 years and 8 seasons later, here I am.
We're talking about the Detroit Derby Girls Roller Derby. Got 5 teams in Detroit, plus a couple travel teams, and we've got 2 of the skaters with us, JT Sangslin, who's also known as ShamWow. And we have Tina Ulianelli, who is also known as Tiny Ninja, or Tinja, because it's just easier to say. And one of our cohorts here at Michigan Radio, Kyle Norris, is a huge, huge fan. And she said, you will not believe who you see down there. You see grandmas, you see hardcore punks, you see little girls. Talk about what the sport does to attract such a wide range.
I think it's a combination of things. I think the sport and the athleticism is really compelling in its own right. Tinja was talking earlier about how you play. It's the only sport that I'm aware of where you're playing offense and defense at the same time. There's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, people like to see people get hit. And anything that you put out there that's entertaining and competitive – and it's a little bit different, and it's sort of reasonably priced, you know, a cool thing to come down to Detroit and see. We get a big crowd.
So you get big crowds at Masonic. And I was like, who knew there was a roller skating rink? It's what, up there high in Masonic, several floors up?
The drill hall is actually, to me, a modern marvel of architecture. It's a little over 17,000 square feet of completely open space. So the way that the there are no pillars to obstruct the space, make it beautiful. It's on a suspended hardwood floor, so the hits still hurt, but they sound a little bit better, I think, because of the suspended floor. So the space itself is absolutely astounding, and that we can fit so many people in there is great. But to add on to the age group of people that come, I think for me, the empowerment that you see in little girls and little boys, even to some extent. We do have males who are part of our extended staff and our reffing team. So they get to see people out there, you know, little girls really look up to you. And I think the first time I saw or signed an autograph for a little kid was really heartbreaking to me because they think it's so cute. And I mean heartbreaking in the best of ways, but it's so sweet that they can actually look and touch and see a real female athlete in their mind. And the way the moms respond to it and the grandmas, I think, if my grandmother were still around, she'd be there every time. They just think it's amazing.
Because you can see female athletes really get out there, be physical. So that's, I bet a lot of moms really want their little ones to get that.
I have a friend, coworker, whose daughter just started junior derby, and she brought her to our last bout, her and a couple of her teammates. And that's a really exciting development in derby, the fact that there are junior leagues coming up. And so you have younger girls coming, and she wrote a thing. I went and helped their league a little bit, and she wrote a thank you letter about how you're my role model and how she looks up to it. And derby brings so many wonderful things in terms of confidence and body image and a way to like be a woman and relate to other women that I love that we're getting a chance to share with the younger girls coming up.
That's JT Sanglin. You'll see her skating under the name of ShamWow. And Tina Ulianelli, Tinja, or Tiny Ninja. You can check out their upcoming schedule, learn a lot more about the Detroit Derby girls, even the upcoming Derby U, open to any woman who'd like to learn more about Derby or attend the league tryouts in June. Go to their website, DetroitDerbyGirls.com. That's DetroitDerbyGirls.com. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We turn now to one of the major national debates. How do we fix America's immigration system? With 11 to 12 million undocumented immigrants in this country, the question is crucial. Today on Stateside, we're going to explore one of the complicated aspects of this debate, that of mixed status families, where someone in the family is undocumented while others are U.S. citizens. Joining me today is David Kelsch. David is an immigration lawyer, and he's a professor at the University of Detroit Mercy Law School. Welcome, David.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And Cindy Garcia is an auto worker. She's an American citizen. Her husband was born in Mexico and has been living in this country as an undocumented immigrant for decades. Cindy, good to have you. And I'm really glad you're both here in the studio. It's good to see you both.
Thank you. Thanks.
David, I want to start with you. How has this issue of mixed status families affected the national debate?
Sure. I think, you know, oddly, it's a horrible tragedy, frankly, and a national shame. But looking on the bright side, I think it really has reframed the debate. I mean, things are finally looking like something might happen in immigration reform this year in Washington. You know, we'll see. We're we're all waiting to exhale the people who want it. But I think the mixed sort of status families are the ones who are really driving it. In addition to the dreamers, the young immigrants who came here at a fairly young age, those two groups of people are really driving it because. You know, you can talk about the 8 to 11 million undocumented immigrants, but that's just it's the pebble in the pond effect.
Yes.
You know, all of those people, you know, have loved ones, people they care about, employers. So it has a much broader effect in our society and our economy beyond just those people.
And when this all came up the last time when Congress last tried and failed to pass immigration overhaul in 2007, I don't remember, am I right, as much of a focus on mixed-status families. It's a different kind of debate this time.
It really is. And frankly, I'm not sure really what the shift is. I really give a lot of credit to people like Cindy and the Dreamers who really got out there. The political elite sort of failed us in 2006, 2007, unfortunately. But it's people like Cindy, it's people like the Dreamers who are really out in the streets and pushing this issue and lobbying over and over again, even in the sort of the dark years when things weren't looking very good. Mm-hmm. They were still out there working with public officials and sort of broadening the public space on this so people don't demagogue undocumented immigrants as much as they did before.
Cindy Garcia, tell us your family's story. When did your husband come from Mexico to America?
He came to the United States when he was 10 years old.
Brought by his parents.
He was brought by his parents. He went to elementary school, middle school, and high school and graduated. From then, they were in Chicago. Mm-hmm. They were looking for work. He couldn't find any there. Some family had already moved here to Michigan, so he came here to live with them. His parents followed. From there, we met in 2002, got married, have a daughter. And then 2004 is when we decided to fix his status. Mm-hmm. Well, at that time, everything was going good. Then in 2008, we were told, no, that he had to go back to his country, that he was illegally here. He had committed a crime. We had fought to keep him here. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, the lawyer that we had took $50,000, and we lost our house to short sale, and we had to find a new lawyer. And it is very, very, very hard to find a new lawyer at that point of time in that process, because nobody wants to pick it up because they know it's a lost cause already. There's nothing more anybody can do. But our lawyer picked it up, and she ran with it as far as she could. And he is still here, 2013, and we're still fighting to keep him here.
What do you think happened when you said you started off in 2004, Cindy, and things looked pretty promising? What do you think happened to blow that all out of the water by 2008?
The thing was, he had entered the country illegally. The law had changed in 2002, but nobody paid attention at that time. So that's what triggered it.
So it's 2013. He is still here. So where do things stand now? Where are you at?
We're starting all over again with a whole new process. And we're filing a new form that has to be sent out to immigration. But because he's still here, we can't file the second form that goes with it. Hmm. So we don't know if it's going to be able to stand alone or not.
This sounds, David, like a complete catch-22.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, as the fact that an immigration lawyer was, in some sense, to blame for this is really sort of disheartening to me. I mean, some people build cars. Some people build houses. I build lawyers, in particular immigration lawyers. Mm-hmm. And I take my job very seriously, and I like to think that the lawyers we're producing are very good and ethical and know what they're doing. Unfortunately, this lawyer didn't. Fortunately, she's also not one of my former students or one of our graduates,
okay.
But that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But it really is a shame. And Cindy's story really shows in a system that's so convoluted and so confusing that having, you know, the right or the wrong lawyer can make all the difference in the world, because, you know, the average person, I mean, Cindy and her husband are smart people.
Yeah.
They can't figure this thing out. It's like alchemy. It's like spells and things like that. So having a sharp lawyer who really knows what they're doing is makes all the difference in the world.
We're talking about the immigration debate, particularly focusing on mixed status families where someone in the family is undocumented and the rest of the family are U.S. citizens. We're talking with David Kelsch, who's an immigration lawyer and also a professor at the University of Detroit Mercy Law School, and Cindy Garcia, who is an American citizen and auto worker. Her husband, born in Mexico and has been living in this country as an undocumented immigrant for decades, and they've been fighting since 2004 to get it fixed. And Cindy, I guess, take us back to you met your husband, you've got a family. What is he working now, and how is it all, what's life like today?
As of last year, he was working, but because of so much publicity that we had to put on the case, so much of so much work that you have to put into fighting that I was like, you know what? Eventually they're going to fire you, so it's better if you quit now. There is no choice right now. So he explained it to his lawyer and said, I have to do this. I have to do this. Where he's working at now, his boss understands the situation and has said, I'm here for you. Whatever you need, I need you here as a worker. Okay. Because you are a good worker, he goes, I can't afford to lose you. Okay. But we're still struggling. We're still trying to do what we can and push forward the movement and encourage people, because I'm not the only one in the United States that are facing this, with one person being here in the United States. And I get phone calls and I try to encourage women and men and say, keep going. Do not give up the fight. You are here in the United States. Your children are U.S. It's up to you if you want to go. I can't tell you yes. I can't tell you no. That's a choice you and your family have to make. But I am here for you if you need the support. I can get you to whatever type of support, mental, physically, emotional. I am here for you. I can take you to, you know, shelters. I can take you to food. I can take you wherever. Just lean to me.
What about for within your home? You've got a daughter. What is that like just with this cloud hanging over your head?
I think it's affecting more my little one, who's 7, who's a junior, because he actually will wake up and say, where's my daddy, in the middle of the night.
You have how many children?
I have 3. I have an 18-year-old, which is Jorge's stepson. Mm-hmm. And then I have my daughter, Soleil, who's 10, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And then my son, who's 7. But it affects him more because even in his schoolwork, he's going backwards. Mm. And it takes a toll on his education because he's always worried. Even when he's at home, where's my daddy? Where's my daddy? Where's my daddy? What time is my daddy coming home? Have you talked to my daddy today? Call my daddy. I'm like, call your daddy? What about me? He's like, nope, I want to know about my daddy. You're always home. I don't have to worry about you. But they do see a psychiatrist because I told them, you got to tell her things that you can't tell me. Mm-hmm. So I step out of the room. And she says it's hard to try to pull things out of them because sometimes they don't feel comfortable. And it's hard for them.
Yeah. I want to look at the political side of this. And David, you did kind of put it very well, that very clearly that you feel that America's leaders let people down in 2006, 2007. Certainly there seems to be a shift in Congress with regard to the immigration question. There's now that bipartisan group of senators drawing up legislation. Is this stemming from last November's election, and now the GOP realizes that it has to have an image that's broader than comfortable old white men? Are they now understanding the power of the Hispanic vote, and can that move the meter here?
Well, I think they are, but I think that's been a bit overplayed in the media. When you look at immigration reform, there are really two components to it. One is the family side of it, which affects Cindy and Jorge and millions of other people across the United States, which is important. But there's also the business side of it. The employment-based immigration system is a mess. We're trying to run a 21st century economy with a 19th century immigration system. So companies like Microsoft, General Motors, the other big three auto suppliers, they're all pushing for immigration reform because they need it to run their businesses. In a global economy, the system we have right now on the business side just is dysfunctional. So now you sort of have the perfect storm, where you have brave people like Cindy and Jorge, who are really kind of leading the charge on this on the moral ground. But then you also have the employers, and it's everybody from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to major businesses like Microsoft and other big companies coming together to say, yeah, we need this. I mean, the devil's in the details, so we'll see how it's going to really play out. But things are looking pretty good.
And what are your hopes and expectations for this this group of bipartisan senators? Mm. I mean, number one, bipartisan. Gee, are we actually seeing Democrats and Republicans sitting down to agree on something? What are your hopes or worries about that?
My hopes are that they'll actually really, as they're crafting this, is they won't forget about people like Cindy and Jorge. In the push to compromise, in the push to have some sort of bipartisan bill come through Congress and have President Obama sign it, that they won't pare it down too much. I'm all for bipartisanship, but I'm also all for standing up for people like Cindy and Jorge. And so, I guess my message to them is, don't be afraid to tackle the tough issues. These are real families that are involved, real kids who are suffering, and they need to have a future ahead of them.
Cindy, would your hope be full citizenship, or would a green card status do?
I would want full citizenship for my husband, because we've been fighting for so long. And it's not just for me that I would be saying it, but for the other families who cannot come out of the shadows and come out and speak. That is their dream too. With them children, even if they were brought here as an infant, they know no other country but the United States. So to them, that's what they want. That's exactly what they want, is they want citizenship because they don't know Mexico. Mm-hmm. They know the United States. They wake up every day. They go to school. They pledge allegiance to the American flag. Some of them don't even speak the language, and you want to send them back? These poor children are confused.
And David, what spell out for us what you see are some of the other major misconceptions that you hear about undocumented immigrants?
Well, I think the whole, what it really comes down to for a lot of people is the fact that people did break the law to enter the United States. And yes, that's right. That is, and I'm not excusing that. People make choices. Sometimes people make it's the wrong choice for a lot of people, and some people even regret making that choice because of all the unintended consequences that it caused for them and their families. But the fact that somebody made a choice to come to the United States, whether it's the right or the wrong choice, they've been here in this country and they've been contributing, and they have not been drawing on the social service programs, certainly not to the extent that U.S. citizens do. So they have been paying into the system to tag them and to ruin their lives for one bad decision. It really is unfair when they've really been, in many ways, sort of the backbone of the U.S. economy.
And I guess we have to talk about people like Jorge. He was 10. What was he supposed to do? When your mom and dad say, we're going, what was a 10-year-old supposed to do?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. For so long, undocumented immigrants, especially people who entered the United States illegally, have really been demagogued. And I don't know if it's the whole, sort of the war on terror and amped up national security and all this kind of stuff. But it's really sort of thrown a lot of people into this pot of maximum security, maximum enforcement. I think finally, on the bright side, the mood is changing. The political winds are blowing in the right direction. I think, brave people like Cindy and Jorge and other people, the Dreamers, have really changed the national conversation about this topic. And you don't – I mean, certainly you have the haters out there. You'll always have the haters. But I think generally, if you look at some of the polling data, the middle of America has really shifted to being much more understanding and getting the nuances of the choices that people made and how we can sort of come together and heal as a country, which is really what this is all about. It's, how can we have a country when we have 8 to 10 million people who are undocumented? We have to heal that wound. And this is a way to do it.
David, and for what you're hearing as far as, and I know we have not heard yet the plan that's been drawn up by this bipartisan group of senators, but from what you're hearing, would it be your sense that there would be, if something did come together, would there be a way for folks like Jorge and Cindy to be able to kind of get to the head of the line when there's children involved and family life at stake?
Yeah, not really. I mean, the way it's currently structured is they would actually have to go to the back of the line. That's why there'd be an 8 to 10 year wait to even get a green card. So all the people who've already applied for green cards through the legal mechanism, which is antiquated and backlogged, they would go through the pipeline, get their green cards. And then folks like Jorge and other people who enter the country without permission, then they would get in line for their green cards. So it's not like they're line jumpers or anything else like that. It would be a methodical process. They would be able to stay here, assuming people don't have criminal convictions and things like that. They would be able to stay here, and they'd be able to get work authorization, and they'd have some sort of status, not permanent status, but status basically waiting in line until their number comes up to get a green card. But they're not jumping the line. Everyone who's in the line is going to get their green card before people like Jorge gets his.
Cindy, I'm going to wrap up and ask you, what are your hopes for what might come out from this group of senators or for what may develop? What's your greatest hope?
My greatest hope that they realize that they are dealing not just with immigrant people, but with American citizens, husbands, wives, and especially what they're doing to the children. It is very devastating. To talk to different families, along with my own, that have to Skype with their mom or their dad on the computer. It's very hard to watch that happen. And for them to take that into a huge consideration, because they're the ones being affected more than any of us. I said, in one day, them children are going to be leading our country. So what kind of example are we leading for them?
Cindy Garcia, auto worker, American citizen. Her husband, born in Mexico, has been living, brought here as a child, and has been living in this country as an undocumented immigrant for decades, a long, long fight that still is certainly far from over. And David Kelsch is an immigration lawyer and a professor at the University of Detroit Mercy Law School. Thanks to both of you for coming on Stateside today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this bit of news before we wrap up today's Stateside, especially after our conversation yesterday we had with John Filo of the Sugar Law Center in Detroit. Filo believes the state's new emergency manager law is unconstitutional and should be challenged. Well, it appears two congressmen who represent Detroit agree. Democratic Representatives John Conyers and Gary Peters are asking the Government Accountability Office to investigate emergency managers in Michigan. In a letter today, Conyers and Peters asked the office to conduct a study of the Michigan Emergency Manager Law, including the operation of federally funded programs. In a statement, John Conyers says it's, quote, difficult to identify a single instance where an emergency manager has succeeded in turning around the financial fortunes of a city or jurisdiction. And that's the end of his quote. You can find much more about emergency managers in Michigan at MichiganRadio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Candy. Thank you so much.